I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver, British Columbia at thecommentary.ca. Confessions of an Old Stockbroker is an engaging memoir from Kent Chauvin. He joins me now to talk about his nearly 50-year career in the investment industry. He has great anecdotes about fascinating clients which provide insight into how to or not invest. There are great stories about colleagues over the years, ones that lasted and those that didn't. It takes a certain kind of person to have longevity in the stockbroker business, and I'll ask Kent about the qualities he had that made him as successful as he was for so long. The book also looks at this time, the COVID-19 era, and offers perhaps a sense of where the market is headed. There's a lot of great stuff in the book about other periods in history where great growth has happened after some volatility. Visit theoldstockbroker.com for information on Kent Chauvin and his book. He obtained his commerce degree from the University of British Columbia and spent 48 years in the investment industry, mainly here in Vancouver, before retiring from the brokerage firm BMO Nesbitt Burns. Please welcome to the Plant Online program, Kent Chauvin. Mr. Chauvin, good morning.
Morning.
Thanks for joining us.
You're very welcome. Thank you for having me.
So you retired last year. When did you decide to write the book?
In the year 2000.
Oh, really?
I had heard that the majority of investors in a fund called Fidelity Magellan, which is run by the greatest money manager in history, as far as I was concerned, had lost money, and I decided to look in Indigo just to see what books there might be about investing from people in the business, because it got me thinking about my own business. I'd already been in it 31 years, and then I got busy. The markets were very busy in 2000. I said, oh, to heck with it, and put it on hold and said, okay, when I retire, I'll make an attempt then, and that was in 2018.
The fascinating thing about your book is there are marvelous stories, obviously, these anecdotes that you have about clients and experiences you had as a broker. I'm not someone who really understands money, even though I enjoy spending it.
Sure.
But there's so many tips, so much advice in here. But the one thing that, as we start our conversation, that I think is useful, is that what works for one investor may not work for another. Is that right?
Exactly. Depending on their interests and so on. You know, I give stories about my foremost successful investors, and they all had a different approach, four different approaches, but the one thing that really defined them all is how serious they were. Mm. All of them devoted at least 1 to 2 hours a day to their investments. They were serious, like Peter Lynch, who was so successful. Yeah. That's the one thing that really tied them together.
Yeah. Before we talk about what's in the book, the economy during the pandemic, I'm sure you're asked that a lot in terms of where we're headed. I mean, we really need to look at history as cycles, don't we? You write in the book that there is uncertainty with the possibility of a Trump re-election. Now that it looks, well, it will be a Joe Biden presidency, what do you foresee in the economy in 2021?
Well, I think we're still in for a very rough time. You know, we need more stimulus from Congress. They've been reluctant to put any more money out to the people that really need it, the unemployed and the hungry. You know, it's devastating, especially with so many small businesses having gone under. I think it's estimated in the United States, over 100,000 restaurants have already closed for good. Mm. So, economies from such a shock, they don't just come back usually in a V-shaped recovery. We did get a bounce in the last quarter. But, you know, we'll work our way out of this thing, but it's going to take, I think, a lot longer than people expect it to be, and especially with all hopeful signs about vaccines and so on. Uh-huh. you know, 42% of Americans say they'll take it, but you really need about 75% to make it effective through the whole population. So I think with the way the pandemic went 1918 to 1920, it'd probably be at least another year and a half before we're have this thing under control.
And are the challenges in Canada similar to those in the United States, eh?
Oh, sure. I mean, no question. Although it's interesting that I think we've had a better handle on it and better compliance from the public. It's interesting, one statistic I was looking at, the death rate in the United States is running about 39% of what happened in 1918 to 1920.
Mm-hmm.
Almost in Canada, we're running at 20% of those that died in the same period.
Mm-hmm.
So we're running at about half the rate, which tells me we're doing a much better job. But, you know, U.S. is our biggest trading partner, and so we're going to follow along with them, unfortunately, at fact of life.
In terms of the work you did as a broker, I'm sure you'd have clients coming up to you and saying, you know, they wanted to invest in something like Google or Amazon.
Mm-hmm.
You write in the book that investing in Canada as opposed to the United States, you preferred Canada, is that right?
Yes.
Some people might wonder why.
Well, I would still, through mutual funds, invest in the U.S. market,
uh-huh.
but it was too difficult for me to follow U.S. stocks as opposed to what I knew in Canada. You know, probably my most successful client, I mean, she used to average about 20% returns a year, never invested 1 cent outside of Canada, and I asked her one day.
Mm-hmm.
She said, because I don't know those companies. I feel far more comfortable in Canada where I actually know the companies. So it's a bias. You know, I talk in the book about different biases the clients have, and we as brokers as well, and that was one of mine. You know, as I said, you know, I wish I'd learned to spell Amazon.com when it went public at 18.
Right, right.
You know?
Yeah.
And look at it now, you know, it's taking over the whole world.
Yeah, indeed. In terms of knowing the companies, if one, say, were to get started investing today, would the companies that one use, the grocery chain, you know, in the, you know, that they go to all the time, or the company that they know in town? I mean, is that sort of the idea to be, say, a savvy investor, is to invest in the companies that one knows well, say?
Absolutely. You know, Peter Lynch said, in fact, you know, he wrote two terrific investment books, and he said the amateur investor actually has a leg up on the professional money managers, because they can see the businesses that are thriving in their own communities.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one of the stocks I bought when they went public, a little company called A&W,
mm-hmm.
I love A&W. I've been going there since 1962, I guess. And so when it went public, $10 years ago,
mm-hmm.
I made sure I wanted to buy it, because I knew, I know it's not a local company, but I could see the business they were doing locally.
Yeah. I can't remember who it is in the book that says it, when their family goes to the mall to figure out which stores were busy. Not because of say bad customer service, but we're doing, you know, good business, or that we're selling a lot, right?
Well, that was again Peter Lynch. His wife and daughters used to go to the mall and come back and rave about such and such a company, like Dunkin' Donuts,
mm-hmm.
which started in Boston where he lived, and based on what they said, he then looked into it. You know, all the annual reports and other, you know, probably visited the company like so many he did. You know, that was just sort of a starting point for him. But, you know, a company can have long lines because of crummy service mm-hmm. as well as, mm-hmm. you know, some new terrific product.
The best investors you write in the book, and you've just alluded to what Lynch said a moment ago, you know, you read the annual reports, you do your research. Were there too many clients, though, that simply put the onus on you to do the work, say, and then blame you later if profits weren't coming in fast enough?
Oh, the majority. The majority of people were dependent on me, especially because I had many of the same clients for 20, 30, 40 years.
Mm-hmm.
I wound up with a lot of widows. Unfortunately, their husbands died.
Mm-hmm.
And so they were dependent on me completely. Very few people will come up with their own ideas. And most of them are half-baked. I mean, I gave examples in the book of some of my most unsuccessful clients. And for the most part, they usually lost money, mm-hmm. you know, because they heard something over the backyard fence or something, you know, it sounded good, so give it a try. But the majority of my clients, you know, depended on me for everything. You know?
It's they should have taken your father's advice: believe half of what you read and none of what you hear.
That's right. That's right. Well, and this is why. I always, you know, I used to be accused of going out to all these mutual fund luncheons for a free lunch.
Right, right.
And I wanted to go out and meet the money managers. I actually wanted to see them, see their body language, because anyone can put anything on a piece of paper. Sounds good, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or give a talk on radio or television. Sounds good. But when you have to actually see these people and meet them to see whether they really have the conviction they say they do. And I mentioned one story in there. I mean, this money manager, who I had money with, in fact, was launching, and his company was launching a new fund. He was nervous as all get out. And it was obvious he didn't want to be there. He was under mm-hmm. protest. And 2 or 3 weeks later, the company pulled the new mutual fund. It wasn't going to work. He knew it, and his body showed it, regardless of what he said at the meeting.
There's a lot of personal relationships, and I don't know why it surprised me, because I guess we think of money and investing as, say, faceless or corporate or you know, anonymous. A lot of these personal relationships, as you write in the book, are important to maintain, and not just between, say, a broker and a client, but a broker and a money manager, right?
Oh, sure. It's the same thing, you know. It counts for a lot. And, you know, I wanted to get to know these people and so on, because I was entrusting my clients' money to them.
Yeah.
You know, and I wanted to know if they're going to start taking stupid pills or something, and some of them did, unfortunately,
yeah.
Or retired.
Mm.
That was a big problem with some of the funds they were managing. You know, you had to watch all these things. I tried to do the things my clients couldn't.
Mm.
That's what I was doing. And that's why I say in the book why I got paid.
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
The other thing that I was wondering about, Kent, as I was reading the book, was you could have worked anywhere. I mean, you trained at Merrill Lynch in New York. You could have, you know, worked in Toronto. What brought you back to Vancouver and kept you here for over 40 years?
Well, I started actually in Victoria, where I grew up. Mm. I was born in Toronto, but we moved out to Vancouver when I was 4. So, and then over to Victoria. So I grew up there where I started in the business. But as I say in the book, of the first 6 clients I got there, 3 died in 1 week. So
yeah.
I went to the manager and said, surely to goodness there's someone in Vancouver under the age of 80, because I'm losing them as fast as I'm opening accounts.
Right.
So then I moved to Vancouver, where, you know, I've been there ever since.
Yeah. In terms of what a client should invest in, do you have, in your experience, do you have a lot of clients who say, who would hear of a company, say, and want to put their whole portfolio invested in that company? Because one of the keys that you talk in the book about is diversifying, and by that, you know, I mean, is there a certain percentage of one's portfolio should be devoted to one area or one company, say?
Well, I always, I was following terrific stockbroker that worked for Beige, which was my company for some years in the U.S., and what I would always do, even probably before I ran across him, I never put more than 5% in any one position, whether it's a stock or exchange-traded fund or a mutual fund. So I always had 20 positions, and I only had one client ever who's in the unsuccessful section of the book.
Yeah.
Who had heard, you know, his next-door neighbor said he was starting a telephone company, of all things. He put his entire $100,000 RSP into this thing that went to zero. It's the only time I ever had a client that went to zero, and what a shame in an RSP.
Mm.
You can't gain that room back, you know.
Yeah.
So I always took 5% positions, maybe 6 if I had a little extra money, but and then tried to diversify with at least 20 positions.
How much does greed, say, motivate an investor?
Well, it does to a degree. There's no getting around it. And, you know, it's going to happen. People... This is what happened with me with a client who made a lot of money in the gold market in the mid-1990s.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he started with $600,000. In 6 months, he was up to $900,000. He asked me what he should do. I said, take some profits. Well, he got greedy, and 6 months after that, he was down to
$300,000.
So you're going to get that. But it's a problem when it's people that are doing their own thing.
Yeah.
You know, he was 100% invested in the gold market, and I've never understood the gold market. You can't eat it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can't store it. Well, I guess you can store it if you want to pay for it.
Yeah.
I've never understood that market. If someone comes to me and says, okay, I'd like to buy a gold stock, I might say, okay, here's one, put 5% of your portfolio into it, but not 100%.
Mm-hmm.
You know, no one, you know, maybe you'll get lucky, but if you don't, you're in big trouble, you know?
You talk in the book about clients you've had for years, sometimes decades, sometimes multiple generations of a family.
Mm-hmm.
How often was it that you had to fire clients, say?
Well, when I was younger and had the energy, I think, well, I recall I fired far more clients than ever left me.
Mm.
As I got older, and they got older, I just let them die. I mean, that's a terrible, you know,
yeah.
A terrible thing to say, you know, but I just didn't have the energy to deal with them. I remember one client from 1972 who was giving me grief about this, that lovely man.
Yeah.
But he'd give me grief all the time, you know, look into this, look into that. You know, when I retired in 2018, he was still giving me grief.
Yeah.
But he was a lovely man, his family was lovely, so I put up with it.
Yeah.
But, you know, other people, early on, I just said, I think you should go somewhere else, I can't help you.
Right. One of the key lessons in the book is that one should only invest what they can afford to lose. Did you find, I mean, we spoke a moment ago about greed, but did you find that there were a lot of gamblers in your experience, eh?
Really, very few. Very few. You know, the majority of people I ever dealt with, I always felt could afford to invest in the stock market. It's certainly not for everyone, you know, temperament-wise, you know. But that, you know, I had to play it. I had to actually listen carefully and see where they were coming from. And some people I talked out of investing. I said, you know, I just don't think you're equipped to deal with this. If the way you're talking, if you lose 50 cents, it's going to be too much.
Right, right.
You know, they could afford it, but not temperamentally.
Yeah. The other thing I was wondering about, Kent, as I was reading the book, could someone who's 25 today do what you've done and expect the sort of career in life that you have, say, after 50 years?
Well, I think it's very difficult. You've got to remember, when I started, you know, 1969, you know, you were able to deal, you know, the majority of investors in the stock market probably were still individuals.
Mm.
As opposed to now, you know, maybe 10% of the people investing in the stock market are individuals. You know, it's become so institutionalized from when I started, and then going even further back to the 1950s.
Mm-hmm.
Really, unless you have the ability to bring, because the firms, of course, want managed money. You know, they don't want individual stockbrokers buying stocks, for instance, you know, from a financial peril standpoint, mm-hmm. liability standpoint.
Yeah.
They want people who are able to come in and find the people who they can put into, you know, managed accounts and so on. And people like me, you know, in a 50-person office, there might have been three of us buying stocks. And it was really frowned on because the companies don't like the liability. You know, it's all changed from even when I... So, to answer your question, for a young person starting off at 25... I think it's very, very, it's always been difficult.
Yeah.
You know, you think of all the people I started with in 1969, it was said by the end of 1974, 80% of all the people who'd ever been in the business were gone. The markets were so horrendous, you know, between 1966 and 1982. And of course, we only get paid to be right.
Yeah.
And the markets can prove you wrong, you know, enough that, so it's all changed. I think it's far more difficult now for a 25-year-old as opposed to me at 25 when I started.
Yeah, you do list, there's a list in the book of several names who started out as stockbrokers who went on to do other things. And then you also write in the book that, you know, people don't last, it didn't last, I should say. What would you tell people who would ask you why you lasted so long?
Well, of course, my standard answer to the young people in the office was I couldn't get a job, so I stayed. You know, no one, I was unemployable, so I thought these people are nice people I work for, and they'll keep me, so I'll stick around, you know.
You, in your retirement, you still keep abreast with the market, and you read all the newsletters, say, that you list at the back of the book?
I really, you know, I've been, you know, since I retired in 2018, I certainly keep an eye on the markets and so on. I'll always have that interest, and,
mm-hmm.
you know, that never changes. But I don't have time to read all, you know, I listed how many newsletters and so on that I used to read over the years. But I've been too busy, you know, the book took a year and a half to write.
Mm-hmm.
And then trying to, you know, getting it published and all the rest of it. So I just haven't been able, and of course I'm not looking after individual clients. even though a lot of the old clients still phone me, you know, for general advice, mm-hmm. you know, I said, just because I'm retired doesn't mean, you know, you can't phone me, but, and they have,
yeah.
you know, they get nervous about things, they read all, you know, this is what I was talking about, headline risk in the
yeah.
business,
yeah.
and the same with event risk, it you know, we're living in a 24/7 breaking news environment, and I think it's gotten far worse over the years. You know, we've got this stuff in our faces all the time.
Yeah,
you know,
too many people would say see a headline, and
yeah.
then want to either divest themselves of something or invest in something. You
yeah.
know,
usually they're negative.
Yeah,
that's what sells. You know,
mm-hmm.
but. You know, I had a really interesting table, I thought, of what happened after certain horrendous market events where the market was then up a year later. It's amazing. This year, since March 23rd, when the stock market hit the lows,
yeah.
you know, Standard & Poor's index in the United States is up 60%, and the TSX index in Toronto's up 52%. And this is, you know, because the market in March started discounting this horrible pandemic. So now we get all these horrible headlines, unemployment and food lines and deaths and so on. I mean, a constant, you know, it's getting worse, for goodness sakes. And the market goes up and people say, how come?
Yeah.
But it already discounted all this in March. So, theoretically, you know, after a year, we should still be up.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. I mean, it's the thing that I think confuses a lot of people, especially when the president says, you know, the Dow's at 30,000.
Oh, he loves it.
He thinks that that's a sign that the economy's good.
Yeah, yeah.
yeah.
And it's not. Now, certain segments. Again, you go back to my book
mm-hmm.
where I said in the beginning, in the foreword, there's going to be winners and losers, you know, and there's a lot of people saving a lot of money now because they're not commuting.
Right.
Right? They're working from home. But then the losers are all these small businesses that just can't manage any longer, especially the restaurants.
Right.
That's a tough business to start with.
Indeed.
So in any kind of aftermath of a March event, you are going to have winners and losers.
By the way, Kent, do you still not own a car?
No. Nope. I haven't needed it
right.
since I moved to the West End of Vancouver. You know, I thought that was an interesting list I put in the back about my walking times.
Uh-huh, yeah.
Everything.
Yeah.
You know, I'm 15 minutes from anything I need.
Yeah.
And I love it, you know. If I ever need to get somewhere in a hurry, I have a taxi stand at the hotel across the street.
Right, right.
You know.
Do you still eat Jell-O?
No. I don't cook. I don't make. Those were wonderful days with General Foods. That was really. And, you know, I still remember. When I, in Edmonton,
uh-huh.
putting up a display for Jell-O, they had two new flavors, and it was ten for a dollar.
Wow.
10 boxes for a dollar. I still remember that.
Yeah.
We had a lot of fun there till the weather got so cold in 1968, I said, I can't take this anymore. So that's when I came back to the West Coast to... try coming back into the brokerage business again.
So I'm a politics junkie, Kent, and there's an anecdote in the book about meeting Don Regan.
Yes.
What was he like?
Oh, well, I made a big mistake. I mean, you know, he was chairman of the board of Merrill Lynch. He was having this farewell cocktail party for us in New York. And I just found out, I guess the day before, I'd failed the NYSE exam, and I felt terrible. Well, I'm introduced to him, and I blurted this out, you know, and he said, boy, are you stupid. Marched off. You know, the guy just financed a 3-month all-expense-paid trip to New York.
Yeah.
And I'm telling him I failed the exam. And his eyes, you know, you could, I can still see them.
Yeah.
Haunting. This is from, you know, 50 years ago.
Yeah.
Oh, and as I say in the book, I can see why he ran into trouble, you know, with Nancy Reagan when she was Ronald Reagan, when he was Ronald Reagan's chief of staff. Oh, he was a tough New Yorker, you know, as they would say. I'm sorry I ever said that, but I was busy studying for the Canadian exam, which I had just written before the New York. They both had different rules and regulations, so I had all the Canadian stuff in my head, you know.
But then you did pass the American one later, didn't you?
I passed the American at the in Vancouver at the not the embassy, the
consulate. Yeah.
So I actually passed one. I passed Canadian in the U.S. and the U.S. in Canada, which I'm sure no one's ever done.
Finally, Kent, have any former clients read the book yet?
Yes. I've always valued these people. I've sent it out to them, and they seem to enjoy it. Of course, I put no names in the book with the anecdotes and stories and so on, but they certainly seem to enjoy it. And, you know, I guess having dealt with me for so many years, they could see me. They liked the fact it seemed to be a conversation.
Yeah.
I wasn't sort of coming from on high and saying, you know, I've got all the answers. And so, no one does. I don't, you know. You see all these experts on TV. That's nice. But I've always valued these people. They've been giving me good feedback on the book.
Mm-hmm.
All positive. Of course, they'd have to. You know, I gave them a copy of the book. You know. But because I wanted, there is a cross-section of clients. Some are more sophisticated than others.
Sure, sure.
But I wanted to see what kind of initial reaction before I, you know, put it out for sale, you know.
Oh, I enjoyed the book a great deal because it made me think about, you know, whatever money I have.
Mm-hmm.
I've never dabbled in stocks, and after reading the book, you're probably right in the book that I'm not suited temperamentally to do it.
No.
I have mutual funds, but then, you know, I never read the statements. I never take the call from the guy. So I might as well just stick it under a mattress even, you know.
I know, Joseph, but it would still, you know, I talk about one of my clients in the book never opened his statement, never opened his T-4s, and that's why he owed Revenue Canada money every year. But I was trying to say in the book, you know, you still have to take a basic interest in what you own and where you stand and so on, even if you don't know the particulars.
Yeah.
A lot of clients got into trouble with some of these planners years ago that used to print their own statements and thought they had what they didn't, stuff that had gone bankrupt, didn't even know it. Not that you'd be in that case with mutual funds, but you at least should have some degree of interest in what you own. It for everyone.
Yeah.
You know, financial health second only to our physical health.
Yeah, that's a marvelous point that you make in the book. That the better informed we are, the better we are altogether, aren't we?
You bet.
Yeah.
You bet. Because as time goes on, I mean, you know, you're a young person. But at some point, you're going to get older when time appears to go faster and faster and you realize you can't make up the time. That's what I was talking about, buying time in the end of the book. You can't buy it.
Yeah, indeed.
You know, it's priceless.
Indeed.
You know?
Congratulations on this book, Kent. I hope it does well, and I hope a lot of people pick it up. There's a lot of great advice in the book. Good luck with it. I appreciate your time today.
Yeah, well, I very much appreciate your time.
The book is called Confessions of an Old Stockbroker. Visit theoldstockbroker.com for more information. It's author Kent Chauvin. Join me on the line from here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.